I'd like to welcome you to the Veritas Forum at UCLA.
There are four questions in life for all of us. If you'd told me 40 years ago that the America of today would be here the way it is, I would never have believed it. The divisions are rather deep.
That's a really good question.
Great question.
Very good question.
Please join in welcoming Ravi Zacharias.
I want to tell you as I start that I wish I could say to you that when you begin a subject such as this, you're quite optimistic that you can find some ready solutions. I doubt that. I doubt we'll be able to agree on everything that is said, and I doubt also whether it'll change the course for some. But my singular goal, therefore, is this. Whatever our worldview, whatever our convictions, because a conviction is different to an opinion. An opinion is something that you have a preference for in a sort of hierarchy of options, and you make a choice this way, somebody else makes a choice another way. But a conviction is that which is actually then, in many ways, rooted in your soul. It is in your conscience. And to change a conviction will involve a changing of who you are as a person. So we're really not talking about preferences or opinions. And so when two worldviews collide, when two convictions collide, the best thing that one can hope for is at least the cordiality with which we can disagree and the civility with which we can interact in the midst of that disagreement. It has been my calling in my life to be in different settings. As a matter of fact, very interestingly enough, I was given a very similar theme to speak at, of all places, in Abu Dhabi, in the United Arab Emirates, at Zayed University, just a few weeks ago. Now, the approach there I had to take was somewhat different because it's a completely different religious worldview, and the issues before them are quite significantly foreign to ours. But to be given a hearing, to be given the kind of cordial listening to, and by the faculty and members of pretty senior, at senior levels in the country, and to be invited by the Sheikh was itself quite an honor. And we walked away as friends with the hopes of coming back and discussing issues. So it'll be a heavy subject on hand. Before I get into the weightiness of it, I'd like to read for you a little bit of a lighthearted story. It's called A Touching Story. As a bagpiper, I play many gigs. Recently, I was asked by a funeral director to play at a graveside service for a homeless man. He had no family or friends, so the service was to be at a proper cemetery in the Kentucky backcountry. As I was not familiar with the backwoods, I got lost. I finally arrived an hour late and saw the funeral guy had evidently gone, and the hearse was nowhere in sight. There were only the diggers and crew left, and they were eating their lunch. I felt bad and apologized to the men for being late. I went to the side of the grave and looked down, and the vault lid was already in place. I don't know what else to do, so I started to play. The workers put down their lunches and began to gather around. I played out my heart and soul for this man with no family and friends. I played like I'd never played before for this homeless man. And as I played Amazing Grace, the workers began to weep. They wept, I wept, we all wept together. When I finished, I packed up my bagpipes and started for my car. Though my head hung low, my heart was full. As I opened the door to my car, I heard one of the workers saying, "Never seen nothing like that before, and I've been putting in septic tanks for 20 years." Never seen nothing like that before, and I've been putting in septic tanks for 20 years. What a way to end that with Amazing Grace. You know, there's nothing like being completely out of touch with what is actually going on around you. You may come away feeling rather elated or rather deeply moved or profoundly touched, only to find out you actually said nothing pertaining to what the people were there about. And it can often happen in talks such as these or in conference, especially where ideas of truth are dealt with, that you can come away saying an awful lot and not getting to the nerve of what it is we really need to address. I hope I don't make that mistake. But my goal will be to get you thinking and to move you in the direction of trying to understand why we even are at a context like this. Why is it that we are in a setting here in the United States talking about tolerance? Maybe 15, 20 years ago when the issues were being discussed hotly and debated, it sort of set the stage for where we were to get to in these matters. And now the divisions are rather deep, the sensitivities are right at the core, at the outer surface, and it is so easy to offend. And you, when you do something like that, it is never done with impunity. The cost can be very heavy when wrong things are said with a wrong motive or a wrong attitude, and especially as at an academic arena such as this. So I hope I will do my best to at least get you to think in an area that I think is critical for understanding. I'm coming to this from a Christian viewpoint. I am a follower of Jesus Christ. I came to become a follower of him in my teenage years. I go back in my own background. My ancestors came from the highest caste of the Hindu priesthood. They were called the Nambudris from the deep south. In the middle of my teen years, I began a search because of the emptiness that was in my life. I was always in the minority, one way or the other. Christians are a minority in India, 2-3%. I was born in the south, raised in the north. There were a lot of sensitivities at that time, ranging all the way from color of skin to language and so on. When I was the age of 20, I moved to Canada. There were only 5,000 Indians in Toronto at that point. Today, there are 500,000 Indians in Toronto. The whole demographic situation has drastically changed. I'll never forget once getting off a plane in Paris when I was doing my graduate work in Chicago with 45 other students. I was the only non-Westerner in that group. So we got off the plane in Paris, and my professor, a renowned professor of philosophy and worldviews and so on, we got off the plane, and as we were going through the immigration there, the man looked at my passport, and it was from India. And he said, "Indians need a visa to get in here. You don't have a visa." I said, "Well, I'm just with the group, sir. I thought I was here on a historic tour of Europe and so on and so forth." He said, "No, we can't let you in." And the toughness that ensued for about 30 minutes as my professor tried to make a plea out of the 45 of us, where one was told he could not enter. And finally, my professor did not succeed. For 2 days, I literally sat in the airport while the other 44 did a tour of Paris and the environs, and I had to wait till we got on the plane. And you know, when Tom Hanks did his movie, being situated in the airport, if he talked to me, I could have given him an awful lot of lines on what to do for about 48 hours. What do I do after that? Go back and stop buying everything French? Stop eating their cheese? Stop talking about their cuisine? Never walk into a French restaurant? Is that where you react? No, they were living with some laws. I was not aware of them. I'd not dealt with it correctly. I did what I was told to do, but ended up in that situation. And so you find yourself oftentimes on a fringe looking in from the outside. I was that way with life itself. I was not doing well in my studies, and in India, if you don't succeed in your studies, you're really living in a shame-oriented culture. So at the age of 17, I attempted to take my own life. And there I lay in a hospital bed, for the first time really cracking open a Bible on my own. And that's where my spiritual journey began. So as I talk to you tonight, I'm not talking sort of off the cuff. I'm not talking disconnected from the reality of a life that pursues meaning or from coming from a minority background, a minority world. I'm coming to you, hopefully, interacting in a way that we can make sense out of our diversities and our differences and learn to live even with our disagreements. I want to trace for you what I see as the progenitors, the ideas that brought us to this point. And so what I'll do is I'll take an extended period of my talk to set up these three moods that came about, I believe, in the 1960s that were forever going to change the West, especially the United States. And then in the last moment, I'm going to hang a small piece of thought on these three pegs and tell you what the bottom line is on the struggle. I lay the groundwork, set up the backdrop, take you to an applicational mode, and after we finish with that, I will have my colleague Michael Ramsden join me, and we will do our best to answer your questions. Many years ago, Daniel Yankelevich, writing in Atlantic Monthly, was talking about the changes in American culture. And he quoted the sociologist Daniel Bell in defining what culture means. And he said this: culture is an effort to provide a coherent set of answers to the existential situations that confront all human beings in the passage of their lives. Notice again, please. It is an effort to find a coherent set of answers to the existential questions that confront all human beings in the passage of their lives. But then he goes on to say this: a genuine cultural revolution is underway when it makes a decisive break from the shared meanings of the past. When it makes a decisive break from the shared meanings of the past, particularly those which relate to the deepest questions of the purpose and nature of human life. When it makes a decisive break with the shared meanings of the past. Culture, then, when it's looking to find a coherent set of answers to the existential questions that confront all of us in the passage of our lives, that coherence is sought. But it is assumed in that pursuit that we've got some shared meanings from the past. But a cultural revolution is underway when we make a decisive break from those shared meanings. And we made that break beginning in the 1960s. What were those breaks that were made? How did it all come about? The three moods that took effect. Number one was the mood called secularization. Secularization is the process by which religious ideas, institutions, and interpretations have lost their social significance. It is a process by which religious ideas, institutions, and interpretations have lost their social significance. And since I was relatively new to the West in the 60s, I remember the battles that were raging at that time. The Cultural Revolution underway, although I was living in the city of Toronto, Canada then, I could just see all the upheavals that were taking place. The volatile issue of that time that was being discussed was really on the sanctity of life and whether the person had the right to abort a baby or not to abort a baby. But in the backdrop was this horrific thing of the Vietnam War and the young people totally fed up with all that was going on, and the upheaval actually began. But religious ideas then were losing their social significance. How would you have witnessed that? If you'd had people on a platform discussing some social issue and you had a university president, you had a lawyer, you had a medical doctor, you had a homemaker, you had people, experts in counseling and psychology and physiology and all of that, and you put a minister in the midst of that panel, you could be sure that if it were a moral issue, the audience would have concluded that the minister was the most prejudiced of the group. That everyone else was rather objective in their worldviews and so on, that the minister came with rather an agenda and a prejudicial worldview. The problem that began then has lingered and it has gone on. And religious ideas, institutions, and interpretations in the West have been marginalized to a point, if not evicted, where they have lost their social significance. What happens when things like that take shape? I recall reading some poets and some philosophers and some journalists who were beginning to talk about the things that were underway. One of my favorite writers at that time was a man by the name of Malcolm Muggeridge, and I remember Muggeridge's very profound words when he said this: "It is difficult to resist the conclusion that 20th century man has decided to abolish himself. Tired of the struggle to be himself, he has created boredom out of his own affluence, impotence out of his own erotomania, and vulnerability out of his own strength. He himself blows the trumpet that brings the walls of his own cities crashing down, until at last, having educated himself into imbecility, having drugged and polluted himself into stupefaction, he keels over a weary, battered old brontosaurus and becomes extinct." This was Muggeridge. One time, editor of Punch magazine, talking about how we had created boredom out of our own affluence, impotence out of erotomania, vulnerability out of strength, how we were blowing the trumpets to pull down our own cities, and how we were educating ourselves literally into imbecility, where we were pontificating on ideas not aware of the terrain into which we were literally headed. I think it was Huxley himself who said that the dangers that lay ahead of us was that with the increase in knowledge in science and all of that, he said knowledge would become a deadly friend if we did not know where to lay the rules and how to draw the boundary lines for all of these things. It was the English journalist Steve Turner who put it in this way, talking about the 60s and 70s. We now believe in Marx, Freud, and Darwin. We believe everything is okay as long as you don't hurt anyone to the best of your definition of hurt and to the best of your definition of knowledge. We believe in sex before, during, and after marriage. We believe in the therapy of sin. We believe that taboos are the only thing that are taboo. We believe that everything is getting better despite evidence to the contrary. The evidence must be investigated, and you can prove anything with evidence. We believe there's something in UFOs, horoscopes, and bent spoons. Jesus was a good man, just like Buddha, Muhammad, and ourselves. He was a good moral teacher, although we think some of his good morals were basically bad. We believe that all religions are basically the same, at least the ones that we read were. They all believe in love and goodness. They only differ on matters of creation, sin, heaven, hell, God, and salvation. We believe that after death comes the nothing, because when you ask the dead what happens, they say nothing. If death is not the end, and if the dead have lied, then it's compulsory heaven for all, excepting perhaps Hitler, Stalin, and Genghis Khan. We believe in Masters and Johnson. What's selected is average. What's average is normal. What's normal is actually good. We believe in total disarmament. We believe there are direct links between warfare and bloodshed. Americans should beat their guns into tractors, and the Russians will be sure to follow. We believe that man is essentially good. It's only his behavior that lets him down. This is the fault of society. Society is the fault of conditions. Conditions are the fault of society. We believe that each man must find the truth that is right for him, and reality will adapt accordingly. The universe will readjust. History will alter. We believe there is no absolute truth, except for the truth that there is no absolute truth. We believe in the rejection of creeds and the flowering of individual thought. And then he puts this as a postscript. If chance be the father of all flesh, disaster is his rainbow in the sky. And when you hear state of emergency, sniper kills 10, youths go looting, bomb blast school, it is but the sound of man worshiping his maker. If chance is the father of all flesh, disaster is his rainbow in the sky. And when you hear state of emergency, sniper kills 10, youths go looting, bomb blast school, it is but the sound of man worshiping his maker. Who would have ever thought that we are living today with dangers in areas that ought to have been the safest places in our towns? From being invited to Virginia Tech after that tragedy, to Colorado after the tragedy there and the shooting. And the day after the shooting in Newtown, we got a call wanting to come there and help people's lives, try to be put back together. If chance be the father of all flesh, that's the kind of worship you end up seeing expressed in such settings. What's the problem here? The problem, as I see, is not with secularization per se, because ultimately we really don't want a theocracy. We don't want a religious authority ruling the country. History is replete with pathetic examples of what happened when power was arrogated to those who, instead of representing God, started to play God. Wherever the church became a state church, the exploitation of the masses became horrendous, and the entire French Revolution, as the lid was tightened and tightened and tightened, as Robespierre and Voltaire began to react, when the lid was blown over, so went religion at the same time, because of how they had seen it as abused and abused so many of its people at the core. Same thing happened in Germany prior to the Reformation. But if secularization comes to mean the eviction of the sacred in the public square, where it's not given a free chance at its discourse, that's when you run into the big problem of what I call necessary definitions. C.S. Lewis, for example, head leads us in a solution here, but let me move back a little bit. In the 1980s, in the city of Atlanta, Georgia, where I make my home, there was a tremendous trial going on for one of the world's leading pornographers. His name was Larry Flint. They said his stuff was so perverse that it actually made Playboy magazine stuff look tame. But Larry Flint had a brilliant lawyer who had one goal in mind. He had a goal of erasing distinctions in the way he questioned the witnesses. So, first of all, it took them over 5 days to find the first member of the jury, because in order to be a member of the jury, Flint's lawyer did not want you to belong to a church. If you belong to a church, you could not qualify to be a fair juror in terms of making any judgment on pornography. They finally got that jury together. And when the witnesses were being questioned by Mr. Flint's lawyer, he would ask them something like this: have you ever been into an art gallery? Yes, sir. Have you ever been into an art gallery where you had to pay to get into that? Yes, sir. Have you ever been into an art gallery where you've paid to get into it, where you've seen the paintings of undisrobed people by the great masters of art? Yes, sir. Would you please now explain to the jury why you believe that to be art and my client's stuff to be pornographic? And of course, on a witness stand, what are you going to say? You're going to get into a philosophy of art discussion? No, but if you're sitting at a table one-on-one with a lawyer, I thought to myself, if he gave me a chance to talk about this, I would probably have a tough time and would try to. I'm not a philosopher of art by any stretch of imagination, but I did study moralist philosophers and their reasoning and moral theory and so on. And so I would have said something to him like this: do you remember the story of Michelangelo when he began his paintings? And he started to paint disrobed people. His teacher one day looked at him and said, Michael, why are you doing this? He said, because I want to see man as God sees man. He said, but you're not God. And a fascinating discussion followed. Point one, worthy of discussion. But point number two, C.S. Lewis's challenge here is so immense. It is something like this. In his philosophical journey to Christ, in an allegorical form, he tells it in the book A Pilgrim's Regress. The reason he calls it regress rather than progress, and this year, by the way, is the 50th anniversary death of C.S. Lewis. He died the same day that John Kennedy was shot. I think Aldous Huxley Lewis and John Kennedy died on the same day, 22nd November 1963. So 50 years have gone by since the death of that great apologist. But in his book, A Pilgrim's Regress, he talks about allegorically how this young man called John was searching for the truth, flirted for a long time with pantheism, and he turned his back upon it, didn't know precisely why. Came to humanism and atheism and the spirit of the age. Something made him terribly uncomfortable. It was only after he found his life in Christ, he said, he took a regressive journey because he had the answers for why it was he had turned away from the other options that were given to him. But at this point in his book, The Pilgrim's Regress, he's in a mountain called the Spirit of the Age, and he's sitting in front of the neuronic stare of he who heads up that mountain, staring down at its occupants. And Lewis pictures himself handcuffed, which is quite fascinating that a man in total liberty is actually allegorically portraying himself as handcuffed, enslaved. And the man, the waiter comes representing the spirit of the age and serves him his breakfast, and he takes a drink of the milk and comments on how nourishing, nutritious it is. And when he finishes commenting on that, the waiter says, you just call it nutritious, nourishing milk. All it is the secretion of a cow, isn't it? Like urine, milk. One is a secretion, it's another secretion. John says, I didn't know how to respond to this kind of nonsense that was coming, but I just let go. And he said, then I made the mistake of commenting on the nutritiousness of the eggs. He said, then you should have heard the analogy, and I won't repeat it for you. But as those analogies were drawn, and Lewis is sort of now squirming, having taken those eggs into his system and the milk into his system, and the waiter goes away, and then he says this: reason came riding on a horse and rescued me and said, you lie, because you don't know the difference between what nature's meant for nourishment and what nature has meant for garbage. You don't know the difference between what nature's meant for nourishment and what nature has meant for refuse. You see, the man or the woman in front of the lens of a camera, whose body is being used purely to try to titillate the imagination or the fanciful thoughts of a man or woman in front of you there, in order to provoke just the baser instincts and ultimately leave you unsatisfied and insatiable, because what they are pandering to you is not a person. What they are enslaving you to is a feeling that no one person can ultimately satisfy. They are creating you in a hunger. The imagination is assaulted to the degree that no one human being has the capacity to fulfill this kind of a longing. And somebody in front of that camera ought to say, "Sir, don't do this to me." But ladies and gentlemen, here I think is the tragedy when secularism with a capital S has evicted everything that is sacred and made a free-for-all grab for sensation and feeling alone. It will ultimately eradicate a sense of shame within a culture. Shame is a desperately needed sensation when things are wrong deep within you. Do you know psychiatrists are dealing with the possibility of a medication for post-traumatic stress disorder for those who come back from the battlefield? To give them this morning after pill to help them to erase all the memory of all the trauma they went through. One of their greatest challenges, what if a rapist decides to take it the morning after a rape? What happens to the medication then to dispense it to somebody who can consider commit criminal acts and yet at the same time want to eradicate the entire memory? Ladies and gentlemen, I want to tell you, you show me a man or a woman or a culture without shame, and I will show you monstrosity in its making. I met a young man in Malaysia who had just escaped from Saddam Hussein's army. He had lunch with my wife and myself. He told me he was taught to do two things in Saddam's army. Number one, to build false passports, and number two, to kill without feelings. He said, "I've become an animal. I've become an animal. How to kill without feelings." Secularization can ultimately eradicate shame. Secondly, the idea of pluralization. Pluralization is also a good thing. We must have a plurality of sounds, languages, cuisines, options, and ideas. Somebody told me of a Korean who has a fast food outlet selling kosher tacos here in Los Angeles. You talk about a born capitalist, he knows exactly what he's doing. When I arrived in Canada, there was only one Indian restaurant in Toronto, and that was a fake. When I sat down there, I said, "This boy's either never been there or he thinks we've never been there. This is not Indian food." People often ask me why Indians die young, and I say because God needs the chefs for the marriage supper of the lamb, so he's taking the Indians up first. You know, a mouthful of Indian food is the closest thing to ecstasy you will ever find. And so I love the pluralistic society. I'm a product of a pluralistic culture. If Canada hadn't opened its doors to me and my family, there would never have been the possibilities that we have now enjoyed. Pluralization, defined ideologically, is where there's a competing number of worldviews available to its members and no one worldview is dominant. The important thing to know is that if that is the case, and it ought to be the case, it is very legitimate, but at the same time, if pluralism or pluralization is extrapolated to mean relativism, then we are on a deadly course again. I don't often tell this anymore. In the early days, I did. So if it's familiar to some of you, you'll have to forgive me for it. But years ago, when I was first starting out, I was in California, not far from here, and I was speaking at an open forum, presenting various ideas. And one professor from one of the nearby universities came up to me at the end of a talk, we had a packed auditorium. And he said to me, "So you're presenting a defense of Christianity?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "I'd like you to give a talk one night this week on why you are not a Hindu." So an American gentleman. I said, "Why do you want me to do that?" He said, "Because I've become a Hindu." I said, "So you want me to talk to you in front of the whole auditorium on why I'm not a Hindu?" He said, "No, I'll bring my whole class and we'll take you on." He was baiting me. I didn't bite. So I said, you know, sir, I don't like to do things like that. I try to cheer him up a bit. I said, when you throw mud at others, not only do you lose a lot of ground, you're bound to get your hands dirty as well. He didn't think that was very funny. So he just looked at me, said, are you going to do it or not? I said, I tell you what, I'll make a deal with you. On the final night, I'm presenting my total defense of why I believe Jesus Christ as we claim to be. You bring your students and they can tear me apart then. It's all right. Have it your way. I'll bring them. So he brought them and he sat, and I had to avoid looking in his direction because his body language is totally distracting me from my subject on hand. And at the end of it, he came up to me and he said to me, he said, you know what? He said, you don't understand Hinduism. I said, I don't. He said, no. He said, no, you don't. He said, if you understood it, you would never have said the things that you did about the kind of logic they use and this and that and all of that. I said, I was basically talking about the logic of the law of non-contradiction and so on. Why do you even talk about my lack of understanding in it? He said, I said, look, I'm not trying to impress your students. Let's go out and have a bite. You pay, I'll pray, we'll have lunch. Let's go. So he said, all right. And he said, can I bring the professor of psychology with me? I said, is he going to study us or is he going to have a discussion with us? And no, I want a witness there. I said, okay. So he sat down, and while the psychologist and I enjoyed our meal, this boy hadn't put a morsel in it. His mouth, he'd just taken all the placemats from our table and every other table, and he was drawing out his argument. He was a professor of philosophy at the institution, fine American gentleman. And then he was drawing out this basic idea. He said, Mr. Zacharias, he said, there are two types of logic. Actually, that is wrong. There are many more, but you don't stop a person that soon. He said, there are two types of logic. He said, there is the either or logic. The either or logic. Either this or that. It's the law of non-contradiction. Either this proposition or not this proposition. And that is a Western way of thinking. I said, no, it is not. He said, yes, it is. I said, no, it's not. He said, yes, it is. I said, no, it's not. He said, who are you to tell me? No, it's not. I said, all right, continue. He said, and then there is the dialectical system, a la Karl Marx, you know, to try to find the classless society, not the owner or the employee, but you find both of them in that classless society, a la Hegel. The thesis spawns it in theses, and you bring together for a synthesis, from a thesis to an antithesis to a synthesis. And that's how history moves in the dialectic. What Hegel had in his ideationalism, Marx took in his material theory, and he's giving me all this big talk, you know. It's the both and system. It's not either or. And he said, it's an Eastern way of thinking. I said, no, it is not. He said, yes, it is. I said, no, it's not. He said, yes, it is. I said, no, it's not. He said, why do you say these things? So he went on to say, he said, you see, Ravi, in the Eastern way of thinking, contradictions are not a problem. You can take two mutually exclusive statements and accept both of them. Your problem is you are studying philosophy like a Westerner with the either or rather than an Easterner with the both and. If you studied Eastern philosophy with the both and, the contradictions wouldn't bother you. We'd all be believing the same thing. I said, are you finished now? Please have your lunch, sir. I said, enjoy it. I said, I have only one question for you. What you're telling me is when I'm studying worldviews, I either use the both-hand system or nothing else. Is that right? I either use the both-hand logic or nothing else. Is that right? The fork was to his mouth. He puts it down and he says, the either-or does seem to emerge, doesn't it? I said, yes, sir. In fact, I got some shocking news for you. Even in India, we look both ways before we cross the street. It's either the bus or me, not both of us. I have a Hindu convert friend who is now my brother-in-law. He started laughing halfway through this argument. He said, that's why you're the apologist and I'm now a pastor. He actually used to be a nuclear physicist. He's a pastor now. He said, you see, if he'd said that to me, I would have said this both hand all that you cracked up it to be. Why can't I use both the both hand and the either or? Why do I have just to use the both? I just use the both hand? Same idea. I said, you see, sir, what you've got wrong is this. Eastern philosophy also subscribes to the law of non-contradiction. What do you think Islam is all about if it didn't subscribe to the law of non-contradiction? I said, Shankaracharya, the greatest Hindu exponent who followed the Vedas, firmly believed in the law of non-contradiction. Gautama Buddha was born a Hindu and renounced that and moved into Buddhist philosophy to create his own Buddhist philosophy. Why, if the both hand could occur, why did he move in that direction? See, ladies and gentlemen, contradiction is a very serious thing in ideas. It is ultimately deadly in life. You live in a contradictory way to philosophy, to truth, and you will find you'd pay the price in it. Listen to G.K. Chesterton in one of his writings. The new rebel is a skeptic and will not entirely trust anything. He has no loyalty, therefore he can never be a true revolutionist. And the fact that he doubts everything gets in his way when he wants to denounce anything. For all denunciation implies a moral doctrine of some kind. And the modern revolutionist doubts not only the institution he denounces, but the doctrine by which he denounces it. So he writes one book complaining that imperial oppression insults the purity of women. Then he writes another book, a novel in which he insults it himself. He curses the Sultan because Christian girls lose their virginity, then curses Mrs. Grundy because they keep it. As a politician, he cries out that war is a waste of life, and then as a philosopher, that life itself is a waste of time. A Russian pessimist will denounce a policeman for killing a peasant, then prove by the highest philosophical principles that the peasant ought to have killed himself. A man denounces marriage as a lie, then denounces aristocratic profligates for treating it as a lie. He calls the flag a bauble, then blames the oppressors of Poland or Ireland because they take away that bauble. The man of this school goes first to a political meeting where he complains that savages are treated as if they were beasts. Then he takes his hat and umbrella, goes on to a scientific meeting where he proves that they practically are beasts. In short, the modern revolutionist, being an infinite skeptic, is always engaged in undermining his own minds. In his book on politics, he attacks men for trampling on morality. In his book on ethics, he attacks morality for trampling on men. Therefore, the modern man in revolt has become practically useless for all purposes of revolt. By rebelling against everything, he has lost his right to rebel against anything. This contradictory way of thinking. You see, in secularism, if it leads to a society without shame, society cannot survive. In pluralization, if you abandon the law of non-contradiction, you ultimately lose your way in reason. Loss of shame, loss of reason, secularization and pluralization, which brings me to the third, privatization. And by the way, my work in Cambridge University was in the Romantic poets. I love poetry. I love to see how the poets oftentimes grapple with reality much more than those who do merely as philosophers or in prose. I had a wonderful time yesterday with your great Professor Lowenstein, and we were taught his love for literature and law, of course, and my love for literature and philosophy. We had a great conversation talking about the poets and the great writers in literature and so on. But I remember the rock group in the 70s, I think King Crimson rock group, they wrote one something like this: Cat's Foot, Iron Claw, Neurosurgeons, Scream for More, From Paranoia's Poison Door, 21st Century Schizoid Man, Blood Rack, Barbed Wire, Politicians, Funeral Pyre, Innocents Raped with Napalm Fire, 21st Century Schizoid Man. Death seed, blind man's greed, poets starving, children bleed, nothing he's got, he really needs, 21st century schizoid man. Take a note now. The walls on which the prophets wrote is cracking at the seams. Upon the instruments of death, the sunlight brightly gleams. Will no one lay the laurel wreath as silence drowns the screams? Between the iron gates of fate, the seeds of time are sown and watered by the deeds of those who know and who are known. Knowledge is a deadly friend when no one sets the rules. The fate of all mankind, I see, is in the hands of fools. Confusion will be my epitaph as I crawl a cracked and broken path. If we make it, we can all sit back and laugh. But I'm afraid tomorrow I'll be crying. No reason, no shame. Privatization leads you ultimately where you are compelled in your spirit to sever your ties with your deepest commitment of the soul and relegate it to the private world. You daren't bring it into the public world. If you'd told me 40 years ago that the America of today would be here the way it is, I would never have believed it. I've just flown in from Bangkok, Thailand 2 days ago. I use a little apartment there where I write my books. And as I arrived late at night all by myself, and the security guy takes me to the elevator and he presses the button and the doors close. I look at a wall. May you know the joys of Christ this Christmas. And may you have a blessed New Year, Thailand. They are 98% Buddhists. Years ago, I remember arriving in Beijing and going into the Forbidden City on a cold January day. It was the first week of January. I walked and walked. You go through, I think, 7 portals. And all of a sudden, past the 7th portal in the Forbidden City in Beijing, just past Tiananmen Square, you walked in there. And as I walked past that last portal, Starbucks. And a sign outside Starbucks, Merry Christmas. Try that here these days. You can walk through Kuala Lumpur, Singapore, Delhi, in the malls, and hear the carols. You try playing a carol in a school here, and the American Civil Liberties Union will be after you. Last year, in one school in New Jersey, they prohibited even the instrumental versions of Christmas carols because the children knew the words, and the words would be triggered in their mind, which would bring religious thoughts into their thinking. Come on. Tolerance? Is it that intimidating? If I look at a man who is a Muslim man and I said to him, you know, hope your Ramadan is going well to you. I wish you a good Ramadan these days. Am I succumbing to his faith? Is it that hard to wish people a Merry Christmas? So even Thanksgiving is now Turkey Day, which may be more reflective of what's becoming of us rather than what the season is really all about. What's happened? To take away that which is the sacred most thing within your heart and relegate it to the private world. Do you know what happens then? You end up without meaning. This is the single expression of our time. When I was 17 and tried to take my own life, I was not independent in my thinking. There were many others who were in the same category. And I traveled through the campuses all over the globe, and I find young people coming and telling me the same thing, struggling with meaning, trying to make sense out of it. This morning I had 45 minutes with a man who's a complete skeptic. It doesn't all make sense, says he. It doesn't all make sense. In the spiritual world, in the world of your faith and your belief, your connectedness in the deepest confines of your soul, if they are relegated only to the private, it is an amputation and breaks away your connection with meaning. Secularization, no shame. Pluralization, no reason. Privatization, no meaning. Can I take the consequences and anchor it for you now? It is this. Cultures ultimately reduce themselves to 3 forms of manifestation on moral issues. Paul Tillich was the first one who talked about in these terms. There are 3 kinds of culture: theonomous, heteronomous, and autonomous. Theonomous, not a theocracy. Theos meaning God, nomos meaning law. The idea in a theonomous culture is that God's law is so self-evident within the human heart that there are some imperatives within you that find a consensus in society. That's God's law in you. The nomos, the law of the theos, God, is so ingrained in your soul that there is an emerging consensus within society of certain norms that everyone agrees in are noble, or the opposite of them being evil and not to be pursued. If there is a culture today that comes close to a theonomous culture, I would say it is India. They refer to themselves in Hindi as Dharti Ke Aadmi, the people of the soil. Their music talks about it. Their lyricists talk about it. Their poetry talks about it. The values that the culture tries to hold on to, principally respect for the parents, love for the children, the transmission from generation to generation, the closeness of the family tie, all of those values they consider ingrained within them. They say it's deep within them. There's a theonomous nature to it. It's not identical, but it's close to a theonomous culture. But then you get a heteronomous culture. What is a heteronomous culture? Heteros meaning different, nomos law, a different law, where there are two distinct sets in operation. There's the controlling few and the masses down here. In secular terminology, Marxism is a heteronomous culture where the handful at the top dictate everything for the masses below. In religious terms, Islam functions as a heteronomous culture. Either the ulama or the imam or whoever, the dictates are given to you from above and the masses are then told to follow along. There is a heteronomy to it. The law comes from above, dictated to the masses, whether you want to do it or not. And then there's an autonomous culture. The autonomous culture, autos meaning self, nomos meaning law. You're a self-law. You're a law unto yourself. You follow your individual autonomy. America would not fit into a theonomous culture. It would not fit into an heteronomous culture by definition. We pride ourselves in the fact that we are an autonomous culture. So here's the question. If we are an autonomous culture, do we respect the autonomy of each individual? If I respect the person who disagrees with me and wants to live a totally materialistic life, ought not that compliment to be returned and give me the privilege of having my autonomy and my choice to follow God and my choice to follow where I believe the truth has led? Autonomous cultures pride themselves in being self-driven and individually driven. But I'll tell you what, there are some questions that bait the hook. Will turn the questions towards people like me or others, force us to answer it under the guise of an autonomous culture. But the moment my view is not in keeping with the view that wants to be heard, it's switched into a heteronomous culture and I'm dictated to and told this is exactly what I need to believe and not what I actually believe. This bait and switch that has taken place is striking, absolutely striking. So we don't go with the theonomous culture here. We don't go with the heteronomous culture. We claim to go with an autonomous culture. But autonomous cultures need to be mutually respectful. And I think what the Duke of Edinburgh once said, he said, freedom can be destroyed not only by its retraction, but also by its abuse. And so I leave you with two thoughts. In the first one, I'll do a little bit of a voice play here, not in any way to be unkind, but because it was so beautiful and so sweet, so sweetly done. In the 1980s, when the Cold War was still on, my wife, a couple colleagues, and I were invited to go to Russia. So we're in Moscow. Quite a cold day, foggy day, and we went in. My host said, "Would you like to have lunch?" I said, "Sure." So we had lunch, and things were pretty sparse then. Everything was a different consistency of mayonnaise. Mayonnaise bound this, mayonnaise bound that, mayonnaise may just make you feel full. But you know, people were struggling. You looked at the empty shells and you said, what are we to mock that? So the waitress was a lovely Russian gal, bilingual, and she spoke in a sweet voice and we finished our lunch and then she leaned over very nicely and said, would you like to have some dessert? So my host said, well, things have changed. We can also have dessert. I said, oh, that'll be lovely. What do you have? She said, ice cream. We said, what else? Ice cream. We said, oh, okay. We'd like to have some ice cream. What flavor would you like? We said, what flavor do you have? Vanilla. We said, any other flavor? No, vanilla. So the man on the left said, would you like to have vanilla ice cream for dessert? I said, yes, we would. He said, you know the genius? She actually walked away from here thinking she gave you a choice of desserts. That's what this game of tolerance can become. We're actually given the idea that we have a choice. Is it true? It ought to be true. And that's why Os Guinness is right. He thinks civility is a better word than tolerance, where you may learn to accept what another person believes, but you don't have to celebrate it, and in civil manner, you disagree. A cartoon I saw years ago with Dennis the Menace sitting in front of his lemonade stand. Sign, all you can drink for 10 cents. So little guy stops and puts up his 10 cents, and Dennis the Menace takes the glass and pours a wee little bit into his glass and gives it to him. In the next frame of the cartoon, he's looking bewildered, saying, "What?" You know, in the third frame of the cartoon, Dennis is saying, "I says it's all you can drink for 10 cents. That's who says it's all you can drink for 10 cents. Is that what tolerance is becoming? We tell you what it all means. That's who tells you what it all really means. I hope not." Daniel Yankelevich's article ended by the survey of many American couples, and he ended by saying the stakes are high. If you feel it is imperative to fill all your needs, and if these needs are contradictory or in conflict with those of others or simply unfillable, then frustration inevitably follows. To Abby and to Mark as well, self-fulfillment means having a career, having a career and marriage and children and sexual freedom and autonomy and being liberal and having money and choosing nonconformity and insisting on social justice and enjoying city life and country living and simplicity and graciousness and reading and good friends and on and on. But the individual is not truly fulfilled by becoming ever more autonomous. Indeed, to move too far in this direction is to risk psychosis, the ultimate form of autonomy. The injunction that to find oneself, one must lose oneself, contains the truth any seeker of self-fulfillment needs to grasp. The injunction that to find oneself, one must lose oneself, contains the truth any seeker of self-fulfillment needs to grasp. I could have saved him millions of dollars of research if he'd read the Gospel of John. That if any man come unto me, can deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. There was a man in Pakistan, a medical doctor, who became a devout follower of Jesus Christ. We were telling our stories to each other. I said to me, "What happened?" He told me the long story from whence he had come, what happened, and the transformation that happened in his life when he began to follow Christ. He said, "Ravi Ji," a respectful term within our language. This gentleman's from Pakistan, so he spoke Hindi, Urdu, and all of that. He said, "Ravi Ji, I was a hostile skeptic. I hated anything about anyone that claimed the truth." He said, "In the closing sentence of this message that I had to listen to because my wife took me there, the man speaking said, 'In surrendering, you win. In dying, you live.'" In surrendering, you win. In dying, you live. Christ invites us to ultimately die to ourselves, to find out the beauty of the real self he has made in you and me, and make that beautiful person who learns to live even in a contrary society, shining a light in a dark world. If you told me at the age of 17 that that would be my calling in life, I would never have believed it. But what God did in transforming my heart, in changing my hungers, in making me the person he wanted me to be, I have not looked back over these decades and found the fulfillment and joy and meaning, and consider it a great privilege to be living in America now and having the opportunity to raise my family here, to make a living, and to be able to share the love of Christ wherever we go. And I thank you at UCLA for giving me this opportunity. God bless you.